This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says reports that it supplied missiles to Russia are completely wrong, and a small number of drones supplied to Moscow were sent before the war in Ukraine. Israeli forces killed an 18-year-old Palestinian man near Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. And people take to the streets of London to protest the worsening cost of living crisis and to demand a general election. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. In our top story, Kiev has accused Moscow of using Iranian-made drones in the war in Ukraine. Iran, however, has rejected the allegation, blaming the West for preventing Ukraine from discussing the issue with Tehran.
We agreed with the foreign minister of Ukraine for them to provide us with any evidence that Russia has been using Iranian drones in Ukraine. We had an agreement with Ukraine 2 weeks ago to be held in a European nation. Our political delegation was sent to the country, but unfortunately in the final moments, the Ukrainian side did not show up. The reason was the United States and some European nations, especially Germany, had told Ukraine you want to drink coffee with the Iranians in a European nation while we're trying to impose sanctions due to drones.
Amir Abdullahian made the comments in an address to reporters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. He rejected claims the Islamic Republic's provided Moscow with missiles in the Ukraine conflict. Amir Abdullahian, however, said Tehran has provided Russia with a small number of drones, but that was months prior to the war in Ukraine. The top diplomat noted that the Islamic Republic will not remain indifferent on the matter if it is proven to Tehran that Russia has been using Iranian drones in the Ukraine war. Amir Abdullahian's comments drew reactions from Ukraine, with President Volodymyr Zelensky accusing him of lying.
The official Iranian representatives have released a statement today. They have decided to admit that they did supply drones for Russian terror, but they were lying in this recognition as well. We are shooting down at least 10 Iranian drones daily, while the Iranian regime claims that it allegedly provided few of them before the start of the full-scale invasion. Only during one day yesterday, 11 Shaheds were destroyed.
Zelensky accused Iran of teaching the Russian military personnel how to use the drones, adding Moscow pays Tehran for such cooperation. Ukraine in recent weeks has reported a surge in drone strikes on civilian infrastructure, notably targeting power stations and dams using Iranian-made drones. This while Russia denies its forces have used Iranian drones to attack Ukraine. Iran has successfully tested the first stage of a homegrown satellite carrier running on solid fuel. Now, the test was carried out by Iran's Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Division. Gaim 100, a suborbital three-stage solid-fuel space launcher, is the first of its kind manufactured by IRGC scientists. The vehicle can carry satellites weighing 80 kilograms into orbit, some 500 kilometers above Earth. IRGC authorities say the carrier will be employed for the launch of a satellite called the Nahid. The satellite is manufactured by the Iranian Ministry of Information and Communications Technology. Israeli soldiers have killed another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. And earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Candil, for some details.
Well, this night, an 18-year-old Palestinian was transferred to a Palestinian hospital after he was shot by Israeli forces when he arrived at the hospital. 18-year-old Mutab Nafel succumbed to his injuries. What happened this night is that Israeli military claimed that Palestinians were throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles on Route 16 near the Palestinian town of Sinjar near Ramallah. The Israeli forces opened fire at whom they describe as stone throwers. They killed this 18-year-old Palestinian and seriously wounded the other young man, and they took him with him. So they opened fire at a Palestinian. He was transferred to hospital and succumbed to injuries. The second one was seriously wounded but was arrested by the Israeli forces. We have to mention that in many cases, Palestinians were killed in cold blood, and then the Israeli forces have said that those people who were killed had either attacked the Israelis, opened fire at them, tried to stab Israeli soldiers, and now they are saying that those Palestinians were throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles in the area of Sinjar.
In the United Kingdom, public discontent with the government is lingering. Thousands from across the country descended upon the capital, London, over the weekend to protest the country's worsening cost of living crisis and to also demand a general election. Saeed Puraza reports.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction has led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises. The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come. The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Puraza, London.
Italians in Rome have taken to the streets calling on the government to stop sending weapons to Ukraine. Rallies were organized by civil society groups. Protesters marched through the streets of Rome, chanting slogans and carrying banners, calling on the government to give peace a chance. Demonstrators also are demanding a ban on all nuclear weapons. NATO member Italy has supported Kyiv since the beginning of the war by providing it with arms. New far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni said that her administration will continue that support. Meloni says another batch of weapons is destined for Ukraine soon. Opposition politicians have criticized Meloni, stressing Italy should be stepping up negotiations instead. And our correspondent in Rome, Max Civilli, has shed more light on the protests against the Italian military support for Ukraine.
And among the crowd, I saw members of labor unions, members of Catholic associations, students, social activists, everybody demanding an end to fighting. However, the crowd and the political parties supporting the rally were split between those who want the government to keep sending more weapons to Ukraine and those who say Italy should stop sending weapons and should be stepping up negotiations instead. Political party-wise, the five-star movement, the once anti-establishment five-star movement, is among those parties who threw weight behind the Rome Peace March. The leader of the party, Conte, has warned against sending further weapons shipments to Kyiv, while the Democratic Party, which is still an opposition party, keeps saying that more weapons should be sent. Even a centrist party called Azione, led by Carlo Calenda, organized a counter-demonstration in Milan with a strong support from the Ukrainian community. So even the opposition seems to be split on this issue, on the Ukraine issue. But the Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, has vowed continuity with her predecessor.
Now the U.S. has confirmed that it has sent soldiers to Ukraine. That's while Russia has repeatedly warned that Washington's involvement in the Ukraine war risks direct confrontation with Moscow. Rami Mazahiri has your story from Chicago.
The Pentagon has admitted that the United States has soldiers on the ground in the Ukraine and far from their embassy, a decision which drastically increases the chances of accidentally sparking an all-out war with Russia. The troops are allegedly only inspecting and doing a proper accounting of U.S. arms deliveries to Ukraine, but many have alleged that their actual role is to provide weapons training and perhaps more. The United States has already provided nearly $20 billion worth of military equipment to Ukraine this year. Both Republican leaders and some progressive Democrats have openly criticized the costly aid, which has only further escalated the conflict. It has already been widely reported that scores of U.S. ex-military personnel and retired officers are helping to lead the war from inside Ukraine. The Pentagon claims the so-called inspectors will not travel to the front lines, but that gives many little comfort.
I think they're acting very recklessly, and they're dragging us to something that could be completely avoided now that you have, you know, Russia saying, hey, we'll use nukes if you don't back off, right? And I think this isn't a war between, you know, Ukraine and the United States. This isn't a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between NATO using Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia.
Washington has known for months that their weapons shipments went totally untraced once they entered into Ukraine. Not only does that facilitate Defense Department mismanagement and possible corruption, but the arms could wind up in the hands of far-right militias and be used to destabilize the area for years, as NATO weapons did in the Balkans and then Libya. U.S. weapons have already been found to have been illicitly diverted to Sweden, Denmark, and as far away as the Netherlands.
When you have the United States, when you have the Pentagon saying, hey, we're going to post all these long-range missiles on your border, Ukraine, so that you can reach Moscow in 6 minutes, obviously Russia is going to do something about it. So I think the United States foreign policy right now is essentially pouring billions into Ukraine, pouring like billions into mercenaries, pouring billion into this proxy war in order to weaken Russia.
With the U.S. kicked out of Afghanistan, illegally occupying northeastern Syria, and precariously perched in Iraq, many wonder if Washington and NATO have chosen the Ukraine for their new theater of war. Anti-NATO demonstrations across Europe have been violently repressed in recent weeks. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
A U.S. media report has revealed that Washington establishment and social media platforms are working together to censure what they refer to as online misinformation. Now, the report, which is based on leaked documents from the Department of Homeland Security, says the companies are working with the government to censor news on social media platforms that allegedly threatens U.S. interests. But the move has raised concerns among civil rights activists.
The United States is under fire for its efforts to influence cyberspace in the country. That's according to a controversial report by The Intercept, which is based on leaked internal memos, emails and documents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The work is primarily done by Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a DHS sub-agency tasked with protecting critical national infrastructure. The report says the U.S. government has pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. The platforms include Twitter and Facebook. The department has justified this pressure on social media platforms by claiming that it wants to fight, quote, disinformation. The plan stemmed from concerns around alleged Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. It also began to take shape during the 2020 election and over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during the coronavirus pandemic. But how disinformation is defined by the government has not been clearly articulated. There are now concerns that the inherently subjective nature of what could be classified as disinformation will give officials in the Department of Homeland Security a broad opening to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. This is while critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
We must rethink our approach to cybersecurity. Releasing alerts, deploying incident response teams, sharing best practices are important tools. But as the pace and scale of cyber threats that we face expands, so must our response toolkit. We need sustained investment to modernize and protect our most critical federal systems, as well as state and local governments, suffering under budget constraints and increasingly aggressive ransomware operators.
Report further says U.S. government has used its power over social media platforms to try to shape online discourse, but the extent to which the U.S. government has spied in the private domain of individuals has remained unknown to the American public. The government's spying activities on citizens in the U.S. and around the world first hit the headlines back in 2013 when former National Security Agency employee Edward Snowden leaked classified intelligence documents.
The CISA's domain has gradually expanded to encompass more subjects it believes amount to critical infrastructure. Some believe CISA's goal is to make platforms more responsive to their demands. There are suggestions circulating inside the agency calling for an expansive role for the agency in, quote, shaping the information ecosystem. There are also calls within the agency to closely monitor social media platforms of all sizes, mainstream media, cable news, hyperpartisan media, talk radio, and other online resources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the legislative and executive branch officials are using social media companies to engage in censorship by surrogate. But the growing authoritarian acts by the DHS and the FBI to monitor Americans have raised alarm among civil rights activists. They say the authoritarian nature of such acts are contrary to the U.S. Privacy Act of 1974, which was legislated after the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. The extent of U.S. spy agencies' control of the online activities of citizens in the U.S. and other countries first hit the headlines in 2013 when former U.S. National Security Agency employee Edward Snowden leaked classified intelligence documents on this issue. Recently, Snowden sounded the alarm again, warning that the U.S. was expanding its mass espionage activities both inside the U.S. and outside the country.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
With friends like the US, who needs enemies? To realize its own geopolitical goals, the US is never shy to sacrifice its allies, with Europe facing an unprecedented economic hardship, partly due to joining Washington's sanction endeavors. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, citing sources, a Bloomberg report claimed recently that Washington suggested the European Union draw upon lessons from the export control regime they are using to punish Russia or target Russia. The Joe Biden administration is exploring using some of the same information sharing and enforcement coordination to strengthen its export controls on China. The people familiar with the matter told Bloomberg. Regarding collaboration to restrict exports to Moscow, Washington has clearly benefited a lot since the Russia-Ukraine conflict began. This has seemingly emboldened the U.S. to persuade Europe to take the same approach against Russia. But this time, it is clearly playing the wrong game. The great mutual dependence between China and Europe is much greater than their differences, and judging from the size of China's economy, its ability to resist suppression, and the resilience of China-EU economic ties, it is difficult for the U.S. to push the EU to use economic instruments irrationally against China, said Chinese observers. Obviously, the EU understands this better than the U.S., and that's why Europe showed no interest in applying export controls on Russia to China, as Bloomberg reported. Meanwhile, Saloni Sharma, spokeswoman for the U.S. National Security Council, refuted the report, stating that the U.S. is not considering extending the Russia export controls to China, nor have they raised doing so with the Europeans. Nevertheless, with its history of abusing export controls considered, suggesting using the same tactic to deal with a rival is very much a U.S. thing. Washington applies the means of export controls in the name of protecting its economic interests, but often, in fact, out of a strategic consideration. It has long weaponized economic exchange in the geopolitical game. The EU is waking up to this reality. It is reflecting on the consequences of blindly following US's strategy. For instance, Europe is facing an unprecedented economic hardship, partly due to joining Washington's sanction endeavors. Its inflation reached 10.7% in October, the highest ever monthly reading since the Eurozone's formation. Under such circumstances, pragmatic economic cooperation with other countries and regions is the critical solution for Europe to relieve its economic pressure, rather than full-scale extreme confrontation. What's more, such a confrontation would only benefit the U.S., while others serve U.S. interests for nothing. As a result, Europe won't easily go down the path of the U.S. wants. The ridiculous proposal of export controls on China made to Europe utterly exposes U.S. selfish nature and zero-sum thinking. On the one hand, the U.S. wants to put its need to engage in a strategic competition with China above the interests of its European allies. In this way, Washington will sweep the deck by exploiting Europe's strength to suppress Beijing, a thorn in its flesh, and subordinating Europe to its strategic needs. On the other hand, economic woes, the U.S. is pulling Europe away from the Chinese market to make space for its products. This has already manifested in the energy sector since the beginning of the ongoing war between Moscow and Kiev. The U.S. is gradually taking up Russia's dominant position in the European market and selling its energy at high prices to Europe, its so-called friend. The U.S. will not easily give up lobbying Europe to increase its containment efforts against China. It will continue to create more crises in the Asia-Pacific region, mainly around China, and peddle a sense of anxiety over the China threat to Europe. It will also spare no effort to drag Europe into its confrontation with China, even though it is well aware of the painful price Europe will have to pay. In other words, Washington is still going to try its best to make Europe a victim of its selfishness.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the negative concept of istikbar or arrogance, what is called global arrogance in the world. And a few countries nowadays in the 21st century are talking about opposing global arrogance. What is global arrogance? First, let's start with the definition. Sayyid Mohsen, what is global arrogance?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, according to the Friedman, he said that when a country can have influence over the people without invading it, and it can change the culture and the lifestyle of people, this is known as global arrogance.
Okay.
Because it has an influence on it,
mm-hmm,
without any having any kind of invasion.
Yes.
So when you are affected on the minds of the people and you're changing it without entering physically,
mm-hmm,
into that,
okay,
area, this is known as global arrogance. So this definition is given by the Friedman, obviously. And later, the other scholars, the researchers, have accepted the same,
yes,
idea.
Okay.
So this is what they generally are talking,
yes,
about.
Is it limited to a specific countries only in the Western world, for example?
No,
in the West of the world?
In the definition, obviously, he talks about the general definition.
Uh-huh.
But when we look at the examples,
mm-hmm,
the practical examples, then obviously we see the Western countries, how,
okay,
the capitalist regime who is ruling the USA right now,
yes,
has become the perfect example of this global arrogance.
Okay. So it is, I think, very much rooted in the concept of colonialism too, isn't,
yes,
it? For example, countries like Great Britain or France used to go here and there and colonize different countries.
But they used to go physically.
Yes. It was the physical one. Nowadays, it is usually in the thought manner, isn't it?
Through media and
the, okay, and the media and the thoughts. That's right. Okay, what are the examples of arrogance or istikbar today? I mean, give us some example to know that, for example, a country is arrogant. Sheikh.
If we talk about istikbar or arrogance from the Islamic perspective,
mm-hmm,
we should understand that the first mustakbir in the whole universe was Satan.
Okay.
Yeah, Satan. Because he performed istikbar against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, against the truth.
Right.
So istikbar means to deny, to reject the truth, and to force and pressurize others to accept your own ideas.
Uh-huh.
While it is opposed to those people's will and those people's, let's say, lifestyles, whatever.
Very good.
So if we look at to the istikbar or kibr or arrogance from this perspective, we see that whatever country, whatever nation, if they try to force others, to pressurize others, to accept their culture, to accept their value systems, to accept their ideas, to accept their lifestyle, to follow them,
mm-hmm,
by forcing, by pressurizing them,
okay,
this is called istikbar.
Okay.
But unfortunately, in the history, we had lots of examples. Mm-hmm. One of them was, for example, Alexander the Great.
Mm-hmm.
He pressurized many people, many nations, to follow the Western lifestyle.
Yes.
For example, when we attacked India.
Yes.
He forced the Indian people
yes.
to become like them.
Also Persia.
Yeah, of course, Persia, of course.
Yes.
But Aristotle, who was the teacher of Alexander the Great, he was always telling him that you are making a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It is wrong. If you cannot conquer the hearts of the people, then the people will never follow you. Yeah, of course, for some days that you with your forces are there, they will follow you.
Yes.
But after that, they will forget about you.
Yes.
It happened to Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great went...
Yes.
And died, and yes. all the armies, the forces went.
And he was killed by his own
friend.
He
was killed, of course.
Yes, yes.
But India remained India.
Yes.
Islamic areas remained Muslims.
Okay.
All the cultures remained the same. Same as the case was with Great Britain.
Yes.
They also pressurized many nations, mm-hmm. many countries to change their value
yes.
systems, their culture. But they couldn't, because nowadays we have Islamic world.
Okay.
We have non-Islamic world in the East and the West, all of them.
Yes.
I think, of course, nowadays, maybe the United States as a one of the great powers.
Sorry, before getting to the United States and his yes. arrogance in today's world and the Israelites, you know, the people like Gandhi...
Mm.
In India, as you said, give us a good example. Mm-hmm. Or people like, we can say, Mandela mm-hmm. in South Africa. Or people like the late Imam Khomeini in Iran. Do you believe in them as the figures who were against the global arrogance or
exactly.
something?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, Nelson Mandela, Imam Khomeini, or Mahatma Gandhi, even in the U.S., that man, what was his
Martin
name?
Luther
Martin
King,
Luther King. Yeah.
Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, of course.
And also, they were
the people who were fighting against this injustice mm-hmm. in the world, against the discrimination in the whole world.
Very good.
That's why they are like good exemplary of this. Their lives are good exemplaries of resistance against this
yes.
arrogance that they did. And they saved their people. They
yes.
saved their nations. Like
yes.
Imam Khomeini, like... Mahatma Gandhi and like Nelson Mandela, they
yes.
saved their people, they protected their values, their culture, their people, their
yes.
nation.
Okay.
This is the great role that they were played by these figures.
And the common ground between all of them is acting against injustice. It seems that arrogance and injustice juxtapose each other.
Exactly.
Or
yeah.
coming together
yeah.
all around the world, regardless of the religion or race,
yeah,
or color,
yeah,
or language, or something like that. But why nowadays we can't say Sayyid? We could see some kings of some of the Muslim lands are protecting arrogance, and they are acting arrogantly. I mean, they are hand in hand with the arrogant powers in the world. They are silent when, for example, the people of Gaza or the children in Gaza are bombarded, the people in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, here and there. Why?
Well, obviously, we need to look at the aspect, the main idea or theme behind the global arrogance
mm-hmm.
or the arrogance itself. As respected guest has said, that the arrogance means that it is against the truth.
Yes.
And then it wants its words or his words to be spread in the world
yes.
forcefully.
Yes.
So basically what happens is in global arrogance, when we talk about the global arrogance, the main theme is to spread hatred in the world.
Yes.
So that there can be wars or anything, so that people are involved in these activities
yes.
and we can rule over the world.
Uh-huh.
This is the main idea
okay.
behind it. So basically, they are inciting the hatred in the world.
Yes.
Which has been changed to the Muslim phobia, like they are now
yes.
propagating against the Muslim ummah.
Or the whole akhlaqi system, isn't
yeah.
it?
They're against all this.
Yes,
they're
yes.
against all these
all of
things.
This, yes.
The main idea is, when we look at the basic philosophy behind it, or basic, we can say, like regime or system behind it, we find capitalism, for example.
Yes, secularism, capitalism.
Now, capitalism, when you look at the capitalism, there are three main things. Number one, you are free to use any means in order to increase your wealth.
Uh-huh.
Even if you have to make people slave, even if you have to kill people,
mm-hmm.
even if you have to not to give people their rights, even if the poor become poorer
mm-hmm.
and the rich become richer.
Okay.
And in this game, in this competition, if there are some people who comes to the market and they cannot survive, it is better than they die. which we have seen the same idea in the corona. Some people were talking about these things, let the poor people die.
Yes.
When there was food crisis, they say it is their right to have food crisis so that they die and we can live. So this is the idea basically behind it. And this is all global arrogance, obviously.
Yes.
They're leading this global arrogance.
Okay.
On the other hand, when they are...
Some of their extremists say, in order to save this world, let's kill the people.
Let's kill the
people. Because over the population, they are using the benefits and the sources all around the world. So they are doing that, really.
What is the problem? Okay. The problem is these sources are being shared with the people, and they do not own it. Because they want to own it. And this greed has taken them to this point. So these are all the, we can say, like characteristics of being arrogant.
That's right.
And in the global arrogance, what we see even in the Muslim countries is because they themselves cannot decide.
Yes.
Number one. Yes. Number two, they have accepted some countries who are spreading the global arrogance, and they are the examples of the global arrogance as their masters. Mm-hmm. So whatever they do, they will follow them. That's why we see today in the Muslim countries, there are some kings, they are silent on the people. When the Yemeni people are being killed, the children in the Palestine, in other parts of the world, in Myanmar, I don't know, in Kashmir. We have so many places. There are many people who are poor, who they can help, but they're not helping them.
Yes.
They're just having their own life, making their own belt more and more.
Yes.
So all these things are because that they are following the path of those who are the perfect example of global arrogance. On the other hand, because Islam is against this, Islam is against hatred.
Yes.
Islam is not inciting hatred. It's the global arrogance that is inciting. So because Islam has become a religion or a school of thought that is against injustice, that is against any kind of global arrogance, that's why now they're trying to fight against the Islam.
That's
and
right.
The Muslim Ummah is becoming the oppressed ones at the moment.
And I think beside the Muslim Ummah, all the believers, because, you know, inside Christianity, we could find so many justice, freedom seekers, truth seekers all across the world, also inside Judaism. For example, the interesting cases about the Judaism who are criticizing the Zionist regime, okay, for the cruelties that they are doing all across the world. And I think the truth seekers all across the world think that this network of arrogance is working everywhere. I mean, the branches, like an international, we can say, company, who has branches all over the world.
Okay. So the first thing is you're free, number one. So this freedom means that even if you want to make slaves and all those, you're free. Number two, that you can own anything, anything. For example, if someone is living in a farm, you have the power, you go there, and you take over it, you kick out the original, you know, the owner of the farm. And if you can hold it with the power that you have, you become the owner. Unlimited ownership, which is even against Islam, because وَلِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ. This is the Islamic concept. Everything which is on this, between the earth and the skies, it is all for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he has to give the rights to the people. So others has also right to live. But this is the second thing, that the...
Like a slavery in the United States, isn't
it? Yes, obviously.
The apartheid and, you know, the slavery and the colored people who were burnt alive, you know? The U.S., who is the main, we can say, protector of human rights nowadays, just look at this history, not very much long ago, 70 years ago. The picture of the people who considered colored people equal to animals, separated the bus system in order to sit down. Burning the people alive in the streets. You know, this is the shocking history of the U.S., okay?
So obviously these are... Why? Because these are rooted in capitalism.
Yes.
And that's the main thing. When the capitalist regime has taken over the rulership of U.S., obviously they have applied their own rules. On the other hand, with the passage of time, because the human rights have entered into the, you know, the global, we can say, like...
arena.
Arena.
Yes.
That's why they're limited... They limited them. Otherwise, they would have done this for, you know, many times ago. So the ownership, which we know as Malikiyat.
Yes.
That is, so one is the freedom. The second is Malikiyat. And the third is you can use any tools.
Yes.
They did it. Unlimited tools.
They did it on Hiroshima. They did it on Vietnam.
So
okay.
All these things, these three things are the main roots of the capitalism.
That's all right. Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid.
Can we defend ourselves with guns or, I don't know, we can't say against global arrogance? Or nowadays the system has changed, Sheikh. It is really a soft war nowadays, as Joseph Nye, you said, the outstanding politician and the, we can't say, because ideologists of politics has said, call it. It is the soft power and the soft war now, isn't it?
I think if we want to protect ourselves against this kind of arrogance, mm-hmm. both software and hardware we need.
Okay.
As they colonized all the nations with both of them, they first trying to teach the children, the different generations of those nations, with their own teachings, doctrines, and values.
Yes.
And then they were attacking force by force the yes. areas, the lands, and they conquered and mm-hmm. they usurped all those materials or those properties of the nations.
Yes.
So it is that really happened in Africa, in Asia,
yes.
in Australia, in Canada, in all these areas. They yes. attacked and usurped all the things and yes. And murdered.
Yes, murdered.
Hundreds of thousands of people.
Yes.
That nowadays you do not see the original people of Australia, original people of Canada.
No.
We do not see them.
We see the recently they found in Canada, you know, so many native speakers and children
yeah.
who were buried alive.
Alive, yeah.
You know, and this nowadays the cemeteries and the graves are found. And the yeah. Canada is talking about human rights, for example, in Iran or in Bahrain or Afghanistan or here and there, okay?
Yeah. The Britain wanted to do the same thing with Afghanistan because
yes.
they three times
yes.
attacked in the last century Afghanistan yes. to conquer, to kill, to murder all the people, but the people defended themselves.
That's
so anyhow, that was the case in India and other areas.
Okay.
I think that's why if we want to protect ourselves against these arrogant powers, of course, both software and hardware we need.
That's right.
That's why I think nowadays, for example, if Islamic Republic of Iran,
yes,
if this country did not strengthen themselves powerfully in terms of arms,
yes,
they would not do anything against it.
No.
So it's the same. I mean, both things are we need.
That's right.
We need of, yes.
You know, there is a main idea behind
okay.
it. Obviously, the places which, dear guest, and you have mentioned, obviously, why these countries are going after them?
Mm-hmm.
It's because of the resources.
Resources, yes.
The natural resources. The countries where they do not have any kind of resources, they're not going after them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are free.
Yes.
They have nothing to do with them.
Yes.
Okay. And even the countries that have, even if they're their neighbors, if they are,
yes.
they have the same idea.
Right.
For example, U.S. is controlling Canada as well.
U.S. Yes.
Because of the oil. So we have all these examples, all these
yes.
things are happening because of all.
The milking cow.
Yeah, the milking cow have refused to give oil and then
yeah.
the U.S. is
this
bringing
is,
more.
This is really a disgrace for a country
yeah.
that the president is sitting down by a king and in front of them call them you milking cow.
Yeah, a president saying to king.
A president saying to a king that we are milking you like a cow. Wow, this is really a disgrace for that country. Okay. Alhamdulillah, the Jabhatul Haq is really successful. It will be victorious by the reappearance of Imam As, inshallah, against this camp of battle. And this is the promise of Allah in the Holy Quran. This is not just a simple promise given by this president or that president. This has been the promise of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to all the truth seekers across the world. Thank you very much, Sayyid, and thank you very much, Sheikh, for talking about the concept of al-istikbar and how to oppose global arrogance in the world today. It was very kind of you. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A million species of plants and animals face extinction today. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in 2014, as temperatures topped 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit in eastern Australia, half of the region's black flying fox population perished, with thousands of the bats succumbing to the heat in one day. This die-off is only one example of the catastrophic loss of wildlife unfolding globally. On average, wildlife populations tracked by scientists shrank by nearly 70% between 1970 and 2018. A recent assessment by BWWF and Zoological Society of London found, when wildlife populations decline to this degree, it means dramatic changes are impacting their habitats and the food and water they rely on, WWF chief scientist Rebecca Shaw said in a statement, adding, "We should care deeply about the unraveling of natural systems because these same resources sustain human life." WWF's Living Planet Report 2022, launched this October, analyzed populations of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish. It's not a census of all wildlife, but reports how wildlife populations have changed in size, the authors of the report wrote. A million species of plants and animals face extinction today, according to a landmark 2019 report from the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, an international scientific body. The new analysis uncovers another aspect of this biodiversity crisis. The decline of wild populations doesn't just translate into species loss, but can also heighten extinction risk, particularly for endemic species found only in one location. Instead of looking at individual species, the Living Planet Index, LPI, on which the report is based, tracks 31,000 distinct populations of around 5,000 species. If humans were considered, for example, it would look like tracking the demographics of countries. Population declines in one country could indicate a localized threat like a famine, but it was happening across continents. That would be cause for alarm. The steepest species declines occurred in Latin America and the Caribbean, where wildlife abundance dropped by 94% on average. In this region, freshwater fish, reptiles, and amphibians were the worst affected. Freshwater organisms are at very high risk from human activities worldwide. Most of these threats are linked to habitat loss, but overexploitation also endangers many animals. In Brazil's Mamirua Sustainable Development Reserve, populations of Amazon Pink River Dolphin or Boto fell by 65% between 1994 and 2016. Targeted fishing of these friendly animals for their use as bait contributed to the decline. Climatic changes render terrestrial habitats inhospitable too. In Australia, in the 2019 to 2020 fire season, around 10 million hectares of forest land was destroyed, killing more than 1 billion animals and displacing 3 billion others. For southeastern Australia, scientists showed that human-induced climate change made the fires 30% more likely. These losses are happening not just in land-based habitats, but also out at sea. Reefs and vibrant underwater forests are some of the most threatened ecosystems in the world, but they are being battered by a changing climate that makes oceans warmer and more acidic. The planet has already warmed by 1.2 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times, and a 2 degrees Celsius average temperature rise will decimate almost all tropical corals. However, the bat deaths in Australia, Brazil's disappearing pink river dolphins, and the vulnerability of corals are extreme examples that can skew the index, which averages the change in population sizes. In fact, about half of wildlife populations studied remained stable and in some cases even grew. Mountain gorillas in the Virunga Mountains spanning Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda number around 604 today, up from 480 in 2010. Despite these bright spots, the overall outlook remains gloomy. Even after discounting the extremes, the downward trend persists. After we remove 10% of the complete data set, we still see the declines of about 65%. Robin Freeman, an author of the report and senior researcher at ZSL, said in a statement, "Often habitat loss, over-exploitation, and climate change compound the risk. Even in cases where a changing climate proves favorable, the multitude of threats can prove insurmountable. Take bumblebees, for example. Some species, like bombas or buff-tailed bumblebee, could actually thrive as average temperatures rise. But an assessment of 66 bumblebee species documented declining numbers because of pesticide and herbicide use. The report emphasizes the need to tackle these challenges together. Protecting habitats like forests and mangroves can, for example, maintain a species' richness and check greenhouse gas emissions. The kinds of plants and their abundance directly impact carbon storage because plants pull in carbon from the atmosphere and store it as biomass. One of the deficiencies of the LPI is that it doesn't include data on plants or invertebrates. The report was released in the run-up to environmental summits that will see countries gather to thrash out a plan to rein in climate change in November and later in the year to reverse biodiversity loss. Government leaders are set to meet for the next level of climate talks called COP27 in Egypt from November 6th to 13th. At the last meeting of parties, known as COP26 in Glasgow last year, nations committed to halt biodiversity loss and stem habitat destruction, partly in recognition that this would lower humanity's carbon footprint. Meanwhile, the UN News, in its new report, wrote, the agency's yearly greenhouse gas bulletin warns of the biggest year-on-year jump in methane concentration in 2021 since systematic measurements began nearly 40 years ago. While the reason for the unprecedented increase is still unclear, it seems to be a result of both biological and human-induced processes, according to the report. The increase in carbon dioxide levels from 2020 to 2021 was also larger than the average annual growth rate over the last decade. And according to WMO, the levels continue to rise through 2022. The report has underlined once again the enormous challenge and the vital necessity of urgent action to cut greenhouse gas emissions and prevent global temperatures from rising even further in the future, WMO Secretary General Petteri Tallas said. The report explains that between 1990 and 2021, the warming effect on the climate known as radioactive forcing by long-lived greenhouse gases, those that stay in the atmosphere, has risen by nearly 50%, mainly fueled by a CO2 increase. To be more specific, CO2 concentrations last year reached 415.7 parts per million ppm, methane 1908 ppm, and nitrous oxide 334.5 ppm. These values constitute respectively 149%, 262%, and 121% of pre-industrial levels before human activities started disrupting the natural balance of these gases in the atmosphere. Tallas underscored, the continuing rise in concentrations of the main heat-trapping gases, including the record acceleration in methane levels, shows that we are heading in the wrong direction. For WMO's chief, the report highlights the importance to implement without delay the cost-effective strategies already available to tackle methane emissions, as well as to slash CO2 by transforming industrial energy and transport systems. He reiterated, the needed changes are economically affordable and technically possible. Time is running out. The agency hopes that the science induced in this bulletin and the State of the Global Climate Report to be published in the eve of UN Climate Conference COP27 in Egypt will help galvanize negotiators into more ambitious action to achieve the Paris Agreement goal to preferably limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. WMO warns that as long as emissions continue, global temperature will continue to rise. Given the long life of CO2 in the atmosphere, the temperature level already observed will persist for decades, even if emissions are rapidly reduced to net zero. Scientists point out that it is also important to understand that this report is measuring the concentrations of greenhouse gases, meaning what remains in the atmosphere after gases are absorbed by sinks like the ocean and biosphere, which are not the same as emissions.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.